cupping their hands to keep their cigarettes alight. Even the horses had an air of grim surrender. They stood, muzzled by the wet cones of their nosebags, unmoving in the torn muck of the road, and as he strode by, they showed not even a flicker in the half-lidded slack of their eyes. As Balfour turned into Revel Street, he met with such a lash of wind and rain that he was obliged to clamp his hat to his head with his hand. According to Saxby's weather warnings, that dubious oracle published daily in the West Coast Times, the deluge would let up within a day or three, for Saxby was expansive in his predictions and allowed himself a generous margin of error on either side of his guess. In truth, the specifics of his column changed but rarely. Downpour was as much a part of the Hokitika constitution as frost and sunburn had been in Otago, and red dust in the Victorian hills. Balfour quickened his pace, pulling his coat tighter around his body with his free hand. There were a dozen-odd men upon the covered veranda of the Reserve Bank, pocketed in groups of three and four. The windows behind them were fogged pearl-grey. Balfour scanned the faces, squinting through the rain, but saw nobody he recognised. A ragged plume of smoke directed his gaze downward to a figure sitting alone. A Maori man was squatting under the eave with his back against a piling. He was smoking a cigar. His face was tattooed in a way that reminded Balfour of the wind patterns on a map. Two large swirls gave fullness to his cheeks, and spokes radiated upward from his brows to join his hairline. A pair of deep walls on either side of his nostrils lent an almost prideful definition to his nose. His lips had been coloured blue. He was wearing serge trousers and an open-necked twill shirt, unbuttoned to the sternum. Flat against the brown skin of his chest hung an enormous green pendant shaped like an adze. He'd almost finished his cigar, and as Balfour approached, he threw the butt into the thoroughfare, where it rolled down the camber of the road and then came to rest, still reeking, against the wet edge of the grass. "You're that Maori fellow," said Balfour. "Crosby Wells's mate." The man moved his eyes to Balfour's, but did not speak.
"Give us your name again."
"Your name."
"Ko te rau tauwhare toko ingoa."
"Crikey," Balfour said. "Give us just the name part." He held his palms close together to signify a small amount.
"Just the name."
"Te rau tauwhare."
"Can't say that either," Balfour said. He shook his head. "Well, what do your friends call you then? Your white man friends? What did Crosby call you?"
"Te rau."
"Not much better, is it?" Balfour said. "I'd be a fool to try, wouldn't I? How about I call you Ted? It's a good British name for you. Short for Theodore, or Edward. You can choose. Edward's a nice name." Tauwhare did not respond.
"I'm Thomas," Balfour said, placing his hand on his heart. "And you're Ted."
He leant over and patted Tauwhare on the crown of his head. The man flinched, and Balfour, in surprise, quickly snatched back his hand and took a step backwards. Feeling foolish, he stuck out his leg and shoved both hands into the pockets of his vest.
"Tamati," said Tauwhare.
"Come again."
"In my tongue, your name is Tamati."
"Oh," Balfour said, very relieved. He took his hands out of his pockets, clapped them together, and then folded his arms.
"You've got a bit of English. Good."
"I have a great many English words," said Tauwhare. "I'm told I speak your language very well."
"Crosby teach you a bit of English, Ted?"
"I taught him," said Tauwhare. "I taught him Kōrero Māori. You say Thomas, I say Tamati. You say Crosby, I say Kōrero Māori."
He grinned, showing teeth that were very white and very square. Evidently he had made a joke of some kind, and so Balfour smiled back.
"Never had a head for languages," he said, pulling his coat tighter across his body. "If it's not English, it's Spanish. That's what my old dad always said. Listen, though, Ted, I'm sorry about your mate. I'm sorry about Crosby Wells."
Tauwhare's expression became sober at once.
"He maumaharatanga," he said.
"Yes, well," Balfour said,
wishing that the other man would stop talking in his own tongue. It was a damn shame, is what it was. And now all this kerfuffle, all this bother about the fortune and so forth, and his wife. He peered expectantly at Taufari through the rain.
He paunamu kakano rua, said Terao Taufari.
With his first two fingers he touched the adz-shaped pendant that hung around his neck. Perhaps it was a talisman of some kind, Balfour thought. They all had them, the Maori fellows. Taufari's was almost the size of his hand, and polished to a shine. It was made of a dark green stone, clouded with bands of a lighter green, and was fitted to a braid that ran around Taufari's neck, so that the narrow end of the adz sat high in the notch of his collarbone.
"Say," Balfour said, opting for a shot in the dark, "say, where were you when it happened, Ted? Where were you when Crosby died?"
Perhaps the Maori fellow could start him on his way. Perhaps he knew something. It wouldn't do to ask too many questions about the town, of course, for fear of attracting suspicion, but a Maori man was a much safer bet than most. His acquaintance was most likely very limited. Te Rau Taufare turned his dark eyes on Balfour and considered him.
"Do you understand the question?" Balfour said.
"I understand the question," Taufare said.
He understood that Balfour was asking about the death of Crosby Wells, and yet had not been present at his funeral. That shameful excuse for a funeral, Taufari thought with a flash of anger and disgust. He understood that Balfour had made only the most superficial show of sympathy, and had not even removed his hat. He understood that Balfour was looking to make a profit in some way, for he had a greedy look, in the way that men often did when they saw a chance to receive something and give nothing in return. Yes, Taufari thought, he understood the question. Te Rau Taufari was not quite 30 years of age. He was handsomely muscular, and carried himself with assurance and the tightly wound energy of youth. Though not openly prideful, he never showed that he was impressed or intimidated by any other man. He possessed a deeply private arrogance, a bedrock of self-certainty that needed neither proof nor explication, for although he had a warrior's reputation and an honourable standing within his tribe, his self-conception had not been shaped by his achievements. He simply knew that his beauty and his strength were without compare. He simply knew that he was better than most other men. This estimation did make Taufari anxious, however. He felt that it pointed to a spiritual dearth. He knew that any self-reflexive certainty was the hallmark of shallowness, and that valuation was no index of truth.